The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello everyone and welcome to September's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. How has your summer been? I hope you have remained safe and well and that some of you, if you've managed to be here in England, have been out and about on the road soaking up some glorious Tudor history. Well, today we are harking back to one of my travels over the summer because at the back end of July I headed down to Kent to the remains, the ruins of the old Palace of Otford. Now, Otford is a little village, as you will hear, in the Kentish countryside, but it packs its punch in terms of its Tudor history. It has been, in its day, an incredibly important Tudor location, and many of the great and the good of Tudor society passed through its doors. And today, we are going to be talking to the Secretary of the Archbishop's Palace Conservation Trust, Nick Rushby, who is going to talk to us about not only the history of Otford Palace, but what happened to it, why it declined, and what steps are being put in place now to try and preserve its heritage for future generations. And along the way, we'll be going on a little bit of a tour of what remains of the buildings. Now, I say that because, as you well know, on my On Location podcast, I am usually out and about recording this. And although we did manage to snatch half an hour, it was a very, very rainy day on the day I went down to Otford. So we begin our conversation, in fact, inside Nick's wonderfully historic country cottage. Let's go over and join the conversation. Hello, Nick. Thank you so much for welcoming into your cottage today.
It's a great pleasure. It's one of a number of cottages of sort of Tudor, Stuart in the heritage village of Otford.
Well, it's a beautiful oldie-worldie cottage with all those gorgeous oak beams. Well, how old is it?
That's a little bit problematic. We think it's late 16th century. The story, as with all the other houses around here, is that the beams came from ships that were wrecked on the Spanish Armada and so on and so forth. I'm not sure whether we really believe that.
Pinch of salt.
Pinch of salt.
I want to create a little bit of a feeling for our listeners here because I'm here at Otford to talk to Nick. Nick, you're going to introduce yourself in a minute, but about Otford Palace and the remains of Otford Palace. But it's the end of July. It's supposed to be beautiful and dry and sunny and warm, and we were going to be wandering around outside, but actually it's rainy, it's cold, it's blustery. So you've kindly invited me in, and here we are at your kitchen table. I have chocolate biscuits in front of me, a lovely cup of tea, and we're about to talk about history. I mean, the world, there's nothing wrong with the world as far as I'm concerned when that's what's going on.
Well, the weather may get better.
Well, it may do. In this island of ours, anything can happen. Absolutely
anything can happen, yes.
Good, okay. Now, as I said, it'd be great if you could introduce yourself. And what's your involvement with Otford Palace?
Okay, well, I'm the secretary of the Archbishop's Palace Conservation Trust. Very long title. And it's all to do with the Archbishop's Palace at Otford. And if the weather does improve and we go for a walk round, you'll see the sort of state that's in. Why me? Why now? Why here? Well, the palace is actually about 70 metres away.
Yes, so it's very close, isn't
it? It's very difficult to live here and not know that the palace is there. And it's an iconic building in Otford. When people think about Otford, they think about three things. They think about St. Bartholomew's Church, which is about 70 metres in the other direction, very old church. They think about the duck pond, which is the only Grade 2 listed duck pond in the country.
Impressive, is it? It is impressive.
And so are the ducks. And they also think about the palace, particularly the Northwest Tower. Mm. You know, it is an icon. Mm, mm. And for a long time, people were saying, something must be done. And so a group of us got together. We formed what's known as a CIO, charity by any other name. And we said, okay, we'll try to not just restore this palace, or the bits of it that remain, but to create a community asset, an interpretation centre, not just for Otford, but for the whole of the Darrant Valley. And if anybody doesn't know the Darrant Valley, it's the stretch of the River Darrant, which runs from near to Sevenoaks, Westerham in fact, all the way up to join the Thames at Dartford.
So can I just add, again, for those people who are maybe less familiar with geography, because mm-hmm. obviously people are tuning in from all over the world, we're in Kent here at the moment.
We're in northwest Kent. We're just to the south of the Thames, to the east of the conurbation of London, and so close to London that within about 20 kilometres of here, you've got about 3 or 4 million people living. In the Darrant Valley, relatively few. It's a rural idyll.
Mm, so we're in a little village. Otford's a little village, isn't it? Yeah, surrounded by hills.
Yeah, 4,000 people. And it's at an important junction. It's in the junction between that branch of the Pilgrim's Way, which runs from Winchester down to Canterbury, and the north-south route, which comes down the River Darrant, and they meet at Otford. And in actual fact, if you go back to the Middle Ages, south of here, no road, because south of here was the Forest of Andred, which filled most of southeast England. And it wasn't a pretty little forest like the New Forest. Mm. This was a forest where you did not go unless you had a few guards with you.
I've heard that very story in relation to Hever when I was researching Hever for In the Footsteps. I think it translates roughly as a place no man dwells or something like that. Or that's the intonation.
You took your life in your hands.
No, I'm really interested in Otford. As you know, we've talked a lot about this and you helped me put together the A to Z of Tudor Places, which focused mm-hmm. on Otford. But I think it would be really useful to put it into context as being one of the Archbishop of Canterbury's palaces, because he had a number, didn't he? Stretching from Canterbury to London. Maybe you could just talk about that, because I think understanding that puts the whole kind of context of Otford into place.
Yeah, okay. The Archbishop, as you said, had a string of palaces, and Otford was the first in the line between Lambeth and Canterbury, and it's a day's ride on horseback from London. The next one down is Maidstone. Then the next one is, I think, Charing. And then you get to Canterbury. And each one of them, you could walk in a day. People do from London down to Otford. Better on a horse. even better on something like an electric bicycle.
I was tempted to ask if you'd tried the horse.
No way.
Not yet.
Far too dangerous.
Yes. You would have to navigate some pretty seriously busy roads in this day and age, wouldn't
now,
you?
Now, look, that said, there are other properties that were owned by the archbishops around. There was an archbishop's palace at Croydon, now a school. There was an archbishop's house at Rootham, which is up on the North Downs, a little to the east of here. But these were the main palaces, the ones I've set out. These were the main palaces.
And so I think our plan today is to have a bit of a chat about the history of Otford, how it developed, who was responsible for developing, what the palace looked like in its heyday, and maybe some of the people and the events that passed through the doors, through the gatehouse here at Otford. And then, hopefully weather willing, we will brave it, maybe with an umbrella, and head outside and go and have a chat and look at what actually remains.
That sounds like a plan.
That's our plan for today. So yes, let's start. Maybe a little bit about how this site came about, because it's an ancient site here, isn't it?
It is. It goes back over 1,200 years. A grant of land in 791, a bit before my time, made by the then king to the priory at Christchurch in Canterbury. And that was added to in 820 and in 821. So that by that time, the priory equals the archbishop, owned quite a lot of land in this area. And he built the first of a series of medieval manor houses, not actually on the site, as far as we know, of Otford Palace, very close, a few metres away. And over the years, there were at least three distinct manor houses, and doubtless in between, there were extensions. You know, why move if you can add on a conservatory and a granny flat? And it wasn't really until the 15th century that there was the shape of the palace, half of the shape of the palace that we see today.
Okay, so maybe since you bring up the shape of the palace, maybe we could just talk about that early manorial site from which the palace grew. And maybe you could just talk a little bit about how the palace developed and who was responsible for that.
Well, it was a succession of archbishops. Until 1510, thereabouts, there was that manorial collection of buildings, which we refer to as the moated manor, because there was a moat all the way around it. Not a defensive moat, certainly not by the 15th century. You know, it was used for fish, it was used for rubbish, all the usual things that you have a moat for. And you can still see the northern part of that moat. That still exists.
Actually, as a waterfill moat, or is it
as a waterfill moat?
Ah, okay.
As a waterfill moat. Mm. The southern part of the moat was filled in the 20th century in an act of vandalism that we'll get onto a little later.
Okay, let's be sure to do that. So who came along and what did they do with the site?
Well, in 1514, Archbishop Warham, obviously we go back a few years ago because he finished it in 1514, but I suppose around about 1510, Warham wanted to build himself a palace in Canterbury. And basically he couldn't get planning permission for it. The city fathers said, no way.
I'm so glad to see that in the 16th century they still had these pesky problems, even if you were the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Well, there was always a tension between the priory and the cathedral and the city fathers. And there was we were boiling up to the Reformation, and a number of the archbishops got quite irritated by the priory making too much money out of pilgrimages to Thomas Becket's shrine. So there were tensions around. And so he said, well, I've got this nice building plot at Otford. I will build my palace there. What he did was not build a complete palace. He added three sides of the new palace to the moated manor. So we had a north range, an east and a west range, enclosing not a square courtyard, but a rather trapezoidal.
I've always been a bit puzzled by that. Why didn't he build it? Was it just geography, or was there some particular reason that we know of that it wasn't a square courtyard? It seems odd shape to
It is an odd shape. It's not very off square or off rectangle. I suspect it was because it was more convenient to build it in that shape. If you wanted a drive, you know, a carriageway going into the palace, it had to get between some other houses, and that rather fixed where you were going to have the gatehouse.
I see.
And then you've got the existing moated manor, and that had a gatehouse as well. Well, you don't want to knock things down unnecessarily. Yeah. So you finished up with this.
So some very practical elements.
Some very practical elements. And it was built as an extravagance. It was built as bling. Not terribly well built, I have to say, to show how important that William Warren was.
Can I ask you why you said not very well built? There must be some evidence of that.
I don't have the evidence myself. I mean, I rely on people like Paul Drury, who've done a lot of research on the palace. And buildings in those days didn't have foundations. I don't think it was ever built to last. And a lot of it didn't last.
No, I mean, we're maybe jumping ahead of ourselves a little bit, but I'm astonished at how quickly Otford fell into decay when the crown kind of gave up interest in it. I mean, it was by the end of the 16th century, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
It was already... in a right old state.
Well, 1537, Thomas Cranmer, the guy who did the English Book of Common Prayer, was sitting down with the king. Now, by that time, there was a second house in Sevenoaks called Knowle. And people who haven't heard of Otford Palace may very well have heard of Knowle. And the king had his eye on Knowle. They were both in this huge hunting park, which extended from well north of Otford to south of Sevenoaks, the Great and the Little Park of Otford. So, to all intents and purposes, you know, they were in the same in the same garden. And Thomas Cranmer, wishing to curry favour with the king, said, "You know, well, Your Majesty, you know, I suppose I could give you Knowle." Wasn't quite as big in those days. And the king basically said, yeah, that's a nice idea. Oh, by the way, I'll have Otford as well. Leaving Cranmer with nowhere to go. And what then transpired was that he liked Knowle because it was on top of a hill. And it was drier than Otford, which is down in the valley. But there wasn't room at Knowle for all his retinue. Mm. When he came, he brought thousands of people with him. And so the hoi polloi all stayed at Otford and got rheumatism. And the king stayed up at Knowle. It's only about 3 miles between the two, so the retinue were well capable of walking up the hill and bringing him everything he wanted when he wanted to go hunting.
Yes. So, I mean, maybe it might be the time just to go back and talk about the palace when it was fully developed around, I think you said 1514-ish, about the same time that Hampton Court was being developed by Wolsey as well.
Just before Hampton Court. So Wolsey took a number of the design motifs from Otford and used them in Hampton Court. Now, that bit's documented. What we don't have are contemporary plans of Otford. So what we know of, you know, what the gatehouse would have looked like, what the height of the towers and so on and so forth, we infer from looking at Hampton Court.
Right.
I would point out that Otford was slightly bigger than Hampton Court.
Yeah.
Hampton Court now, of course, is much bigger because it's got the Stuart and Georgian additions.
Yes. But it is
in the day.
It's incredible, actually, when you come here and you think, wow, this place was bigger than Hampton Court. I mean, it's amazing, but it's lovely that we've got that comparator that helps us visualise it. So just to be clear, we have here a palace which is a double courtyard house with the outer sort of base court, much as you have at Hampton Court.
Yes.
And then an inner gateway, an inner gatehouse that was across this moat, where you had this complex of, and that's where the posh buildings
the,
were.
Well, not all the posh buildings.
No, there were some stables and stuff, wasn't there?
And the Northwest Tower. The Northwest Tower, which is the remaining tower, was high status accommodation.
Okay, so maybe let's rewind that back a bit. So, where exactly, what was the extent of the sort of the privy lodgings then at Otford? Where would we have been Where would we have to go in the palace to find those?
You'd have to go to the south side, to the moated manor, which is where the archbishop lived, where the chapel was. And we know roughly where the, well, we know fairly exactly actually where the chapel was. The walls are still there. We'll get back to the vandalism later. And there was a great hall there and so on and so forth. It was all very higgledy-piggledy. It had grown up over hundreds of years. Mm. And there wasn't so much a large inner court as a series of smaller courts. The great court, which was now enclosed by these three new ranges, is substantial. You know, you could hold tournaments in there, and we don't, because it's a scheduled monument. You're not allowed to have large horses digging the ground up. The most of what was underneath it was mud. Mm. There weren't any buildings there.
No, right.
But you have the three walls. The West Range and the East Range were mainly accommodation.
Yeah.
You've got the Great Gatehouse, which is what people would see. They would come into Otford. They would start down the roadway to the palace by the pond. Go just outside the church, always a good omen. And then they would see this huge gatehouse.
Please describe it to us, because it was quite phenomenal.
Well, five stories high with turrets and stuff like that. You know, think the gatehouse at Lambeth Palace or Hampton Court, that sort of size. Hmm. Two sets of gates, and it would be manned by people with sharp swords, to make sure that only those who had business were allowed in. Mm. Then in the late 17th century, a lot of it fell down and we're left with part of one side of the gatehouse. I make it sound as though, you know, there's nothing to see, but actually there's lots to see.
And we're going to go and see
and
it.
We're
going
to go and see it. And the weather is improving.
We can see out the window. It's stopped raining, folks. So we are going to be able to get outside. So maybe we should just then focus on some of the characters who pass through the doors here at Otford, because quite a few of the great and the good of the Tudor world were here at Otford. Maybe you could talk about those and some of the principal events that got, you know, sort of that happened here during the Tudor era.
Well, it was not only on the route between London and Canterbury, it was on the route between London and Dover. So if you were a Pope's emissary, you know, a cardinal making the journey, it's only 1,000 miles or so. Better in summer than it is in winter, because you have to cross the Alps. And they didn't have the Mont Blanc tunnel in those days.
Okay.
Then Otford was a natural place to stop and recoup before you got to London. So we had people like Cardinal Campeggio, who stayed, you know, church folk together.
Mm-hmm.
Because remember that at that time, the English church was a Catholic church. Campeggio was sent as a legate to the court to try and resolve some of the king's business. Mm. Finished up getting, as I understand it, sort of seduced by Wolsey. I don't mean in a, you know,
in an erotic way.
In an erotic way, but you know, he was drawn to the other side, so to speak. Erasmus was here. A lot of correspondence between Erasmus and William Warham. Erasmus suffered from kidney stones, and there's some quite amusing correspondence between them, with Warham saying, look, you know, you really shouldn't worry too much about these kidney stones. You think of me and all these big stones I've got to move around to get my palace built. Even if you don't know about Holbein the painter, you'll know about that classic portrait of Henry VIII, arms akimbo, which is demonstrating Henry's power. And so Holbein stayed here.
What, do we know what Holbein was doing here? Was he with the court, or was he being sent here? Was this a social visit? Do we have any idea?
I think it was a social visit, because okay. He came several times. And the king wasn't always here then. So I should think he was, you know, buddies with William Warham. And why not? He seems to have been a reasonably pleasant fellow.
Must have known a lot of people.
Didn't like Wolsey.
Did he not?
No, Wolsey and Warham were not the best of friends. But
was that jealousy between them, do you think?
Probably. Then, of course, the king himself was here about his business. He used to travel the countryside, bankrupting people.
And of course, we've got the Field of Cloth of Gold on the
way. We have the Field of the Cloth of Gold.
That was probably one of the big events, wasn't it? That
yes.
Here.
Yes, the Bling Fest in just outside Calais, where the King and Catherine of Aragon, and the exact number is a little uncertain, but probably the order of 4,000 people came and stayed overnight at Otford. Where they all stayed, because even, you know, one of the most magnificent houses in England, as it was described, was not big enough for 4,000. I should think they were under the hedgerows and, you know,
tents all over the place.
And talking of tents, of course, they brought with them what we call the Flat Pack Palace.
Yes.
It was a bling fest. It was two young kings out to impress the other.
And they were all here at Otford. I'm just imagining how, you know, the village, a sleepy little village, suddenly exploding with life with all these courtiers.
Yeah. We were hoping last year to do a partial reenactment.
Oh, really? That's ambitious.
We have a play, or we had a play ready to go, but of course, COVID scuppered that for us.
COVID got in the way.
Which was sad. But they stayed here. They then moved on over a period of days to Calais, and erected the palace at Guisnes. Mm-hmm. And if anybody hasn't seen that, seen the pictures of it, well worth it. I mean, you know, imagine taking that by land and sea and putting it up for a 1 week event. I think it's worth also looking at what happened to the palace in the 100 years or so that followed that transfer from Canterbury, from the archbishops, to the king. After Henry died, then of course we had Elizabeth, and Elizabeth really didn't have very much interest in Otford, although she did spend some money on it. And she was pestered by the Sydney family, who wanted to buy Otford Palace. Now, they of course had their own major seat elsewhere in Kent, but this was good hunting territory, so they fancied a hunting lodge here.
So they were in Penshurst, weren't they, which is not too far away from here?
No, not now, not in a car.
Not in a car.
You know, a decent ride on a horse.
Yes.
And eventually in 1601, Elizabeth I, needing money for her wars, sold the palace to the Sydneys. They converted the North Range into a lodge. By this time, the moated manor was falling into serious disrepair. And that continued. That continued for the rest of that century. So that by the end of the 17th century, there was not an awful lot left. They didn't have builders merchants in those days. So if you needed stone or woodwork for your new house, then you found a suitable site and you robbed it. And certainly by the time we get to the end of the 17th century, it was being used as a farm. Some of the buildings had been thatched, and that decline continued.
And I guess local people, just going back to your point, were taking away some of the materials from
Absolutely.
The palace as it was falling down. Because I often get people say, ask me, how do these palaces seem to decline and fall into decay so quickly? Or the abbeys that were dissolved at the dissolution. And a lot of it is because people came and they just took the materials away. And that's
yes. Well, when we go to the gatehouse, I can show you a Tudor door, which we believe came from the palace. And that, for at least 300 years, was being used as the back garden gate of a house in Otford. Gate is an understatement. I mean, it's, you know, 6 feet tall. And you can just imagine the scene, you know, sort of...
Yes.
Harry saying, well, actually, I need a gate around my in my fence. And, well, John, he can bring the cart over on Saturday. Nobody's looking. We'll just load it on and take it away.
Yes, you can, can't you?
We've now rescued that.
Yes. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that. And is that a good cue for us to maybe try and head outside and go for a little walk?
Well, it's not raining, so
I think
why
it
not?
Is. Let's do it.
Before we go any further, if you enjoy these podcasts, did you know that you can support my work by becoming a patron of the show for as little as $1 a month? A link to find out more about this programme and the different levels of sponsorship available is included in the description associated with this podcast. And while I can't thank you in person, here's a big mwah to say a massive thank you from me. So, now it's back to the show.
Now we've come outside your lovely little cottage and we're heading down the current drive. Now this wasn't this isn't exactly on the main position, the position
no.
of the original drive.
No, the original drive would have been about 10 metres or so
to our left.
To our left.
And it's now that's through looks like sort of private property there.
Well, that's the vicarage car park. The church car park.
Okay, right.
And the reason why we know that the drive went through there is that when they dug the ditches, they could actually see the bits of the roadbed.
So it actually has been, it's been archaeologically pinpointed.
It has.
Excellent.
It has.
So we're walking down, and I can already see, I confess I've been here a couple of times before, so I'm kind of prepared for, and I love ruins. I absolutely love ruins. But here we are. We're right in front of what was the original, the North Range.
The North Range, half of the North Range. So what you're looking at there on the right-hand side is the remains of the Northwest Tower. And we think there was another story on top, at least one story on top, and towers and decorations and stuff like that. Then if you turn your attention to the left, we've got what remains of the gatehouse.
Yes.
Now that is the bottom part of one half of the gatehouse. So what we're looking at here is half of the North Range. What you have to imagine, and it's quite difficult without the picture, is to take a mirror of that and put it over there in the vicarage garden. Yeah. And you can see in the Vicarage Garden where the foundations for the northeast tower would be.
Ah.
And there are still remains of the ragstone. That's a local Kentish stone from which a lot of the tower is made. You can still see the remains of those walls.
In the
Vicarage Garden.
Great.
What you can't see is the remains of the gatehouse, because that was all carted away to build somebody else's house.
Oh, I see. But
now, in between, we've got three cottages,
mm-hmm.
And those are the smallest cottages you've ever seen. They're, because they are the thickness of a wall. You know, it was, in Tudor times, a room downstairs and a covered walkway, right. Open, but covered, so that people could walk all the way around
facing
in inclement weather.
Facing into base course.
Yeah.
As you say, they could take shelter if it
on
was
days true. Like today.
On days exactly like
today. On days
today.
Like today. So what we'll do is we'll walk down and we'll go and have a look in the gatehouse.
Yes, please do that. Today it's just as you said, it's a fragment of the incredible building that it must have been. But
yes.
Just the fact that it survives at all, I think, is wonderful.
Well, in some respects, it's fortunate because if there was all of it, we'd never be able to afford to maintain it.
Yes, there is that. So these are private cottages, but as you
those
said...
Those are three private cottages.
But around the building, you're quite free to walk.
Of course you are, yes, of course you are. Right, let me... unlock, because I want to show you the Tudor door. Right, do come inside.
Okay.
So this is the gatehouse.
We're inside what remains of the gatehouse now.
And that is a model.
That is the model of what the palace looked like.
Of what the palace looked like.
That's amazing. Who did this model?
A guy called Rod Shelton, who lives in the village, and has made a number of models of... he's made a model of Lullingston Villa and the Oast houses and so on and so forth. Now, what you have to remember is that there's a certain amount of guesstimation going on here.
Mm.
The gatehouse, we think, is too low, as are the towers, but...
It gives a feel. And that's what you want.
It gives a feel.
And I just want to say to those people listening in that, as ever, we will have a show notes page associated with this podcast, and we'll put some images in there. If you're not looking at my A to Z on YouTube, and many of these images are actually included in that video, there will be this show notes page, so just look out for the link in the description below.
And on the website... there is a short video, which is a video tour of this model.
Oh, fantastic. So that's something that definitely needs to be done.
There is more information about Otford Palace between your resources and ours than anybody would ever want to know.
Exactly. Exactly. There is a door.
So there is somebody's back garden gate.
Goodness me, look at that baby.
So we're looking at something which is over 500 years old. It's slowly drying out in here.
It's in pretty good condition. I mean, really, if it's just been not been looked after and it's just been outside
for all
of that time.
We did a deal with the very generous owner of that particular house. We gave him a new gate.
Did you?
And he gave us this.
Well, fair dues, but I think you've got the better end of the bargain.
I think we've got the better end of the bargain.
So we're standing now in what was the lower part of one of the bits of gatehouse. So this would be, what, a guard room or something
yes,
like that?
Yes, this would have been a guard room. Its more recent history was that between the wars, it was used as the village mortuary. It was used as a room by the scouts and then the guides. And then we took it over.
Brilliant.
So where we are now is on the road underneath the gatehouse into the Great Court. And what we're looking at is the door from which an armed man with a pointy stick would come out and say, you know, are you a genuine visitor? Can you really come? And if you look, you can see that people weren't quite that short in those days.
No.
The surface here has gone up by about 40 centimetres. One of the things that we're going to be doing over the next few years, we have to get all the proper permissions from it, but one of the things we're going to be doing over the next few years is to excavate here.
Oh, really?
Not because we think there are any buried foundations, but because this was a thoroughfare.
Yes.
This is where people would have dropped things. We don't know what, but...
Let's find them.
And continuing down beside the gatehouse, we're now just going past where the inner gate would have been. Mm-hmm. And we come into the Great Court.
We're into Base Court.
Yeah.
I'm arriving. This is
you're arriving.
This is 1520. I'm part of the entourage.
Yeah, you've been allowed in by the man with the pointy stick. And what you're looking at is half of it.
Yeah.
What you're looking at is half of it. Remember, this is the centre line.
Yeah.
So you've got over to our left. You've got as much again.
Because there's a hedge there now.
There's now a hedge. There's the other side of the hedge, there's a cottage. And you'd have the East Range. And the far side of that, what is now Castle House, which would have been the estate house. And in between, lots of stables and you know, all the usual paraphernalia that goes with a great house. Now, over there where the trees are...
Yes. Straight ahead of us. So we're looking straight ahead across what was Base Court. It's now a grassy plateau of land. There's a huge range of trees at the other side of what would have been the courtyard. So that's what we're talking about at the moment.
Yes. And just the far side of those trees is the moat.
Right.
The northern arm of the moat that went round the moated manor. And the moated manor isn't there anymore, but you can see through the trees... the houses that have been built by
on that side
are Vandal.
Yes. I'm reckoning, I used to run the 100 metres when I was at school. I reckon that's about 100 metres away or so, just to give people a sense. I mean, you probably know the exact measurements, but that's...
I do, but I can't quote them for you. I'm sorry.
It's okay. But I'm thinking, that's about 100 metres away. Just gives you guys at home listening an idea of the scale.
It's seriously big. You could get... a war horse up to full trot.
Yeah.
In that.
Yeah, wonderful. So where do we go to next?
And now we're going to walk along the Great Court. This is one of a number of streams. Now, there's a nice story about Thomas Becket. Remember that the archbishops came past here regularly. Thomas Becket worked a miracle, and he stuck his staff in the ground over there, and out came a spring of clear water. Now, in fact, if he'd done that almost anywhere in this area, he'd have found a spring. I mean, there are dozens of springs around here. Where he stuck his staff in over there, about 150 metres, is known as Becket's Well. And there is a stream that comes out of Becket's Well. This one isn't it. This is from yet another stream, another spring.
So plenty of fresh water. Which is good.
And you can feed the ponds, so you can keep fish, the stew ponds and so on. And, as we'll see in a minute, you can also use the water to carry away the waste.
Ah, right, okay. And as we're walking along, we're at the other side of the North Range and the cottages, and I can see all these arched...
where the cottages have been converted, the North Range has been converted, doorways and windows have been bricked up. And if you look, the ground floor brick is Tudor.
Yes.
Go up to the first floor and it's Victorian.
Of course, you can see that very clearly. The brick changes, doesn't it?
The brick changes.
Absolutely.
And it was in Victorian times that that was constructed for dwellings, for farm dwellings, and the roof was put on. Then between the wars, they were condemned as unfit for human habitation, after the Second War, they were refurbished and
brought back to life.
People can live in them again.
But those bricked-up archways, which are the typical Tudor architecture there, that was the open gallery that people would have walked around?
No, the ground floor would have been rooms.
Ah, okay.
The gallery was on the top.
Oh, it was above them?
It was above. timber gallery.
So were these arched? Were they all windows? Or
yeah, windows.
Right.
That one I think was a door. That one there was a door. That one's been opened up again fairly recently.
Oh, I see.
And you can see here the southern side of the gatehouse, the Dovecot Tower.
Yes.
If we go in there, there's still an operational dovecot, and various windows which have been blocked up and so on. People did then what they still do now. They make changes to their
all
houses.
All the time, yes.
You know, we don't want a window. We want to put a stairway in there. We don't want a window at that point. We'll block it up. And
yeah.
So the blocked windows here have nothing to do with the window tax.
It's just fashion and it's practicality.
Fashion and practicality. Mm. And I want to change things a bit.
Mm.
Now, if we just stop here,
yep,
we're level with the Northwest Tower. And if you turn and face south, you can see an undulation in the ground.
Yes.
And if you look at the LIDAR, the laser imaging, which was done from about 5,000 feet, which picks up changes in ground level very accurately, this was the West Range.
So we're basically
the line of the West Range.
Standing on where the West Range
would have
been.
Yeah.
And this is, am I right, at the first floor level? That's where the big privy gallery ran across?
The gallery would have been at the first floor level as well.
Yeah.
We think that people could go all the way around here for assignations in the twilight and more practically just to keep themselves dry when they wanted to move around undercover. Now, the area over there to your right, that was the pleasure gardens. And that's documented by some of the visitors like Erasmus who came. And there were little summer houses. They were called little houses of pleasure, which is a trifle ambiguous today.
Yes.
But they were little gazebos, little
yes,
summer houses. The vegetable gardens were over the other side by the stables and
so they were over on the far side, the completely
on the far
opposite,
side.
The working side.
This was the pretty side.
Yeah, where all the high status guests would enjoy.
Absolutely,
yeah,
absolutely. Because remember that something like Otford Palace would have been pretty much self-sufficient with its home farms. It would grow everything it needed. It would have all the meat that it needed. It would keep its own fish, probably turn a modest profit. You'd need it actually if the king came to stay.
Yeah, yes, you really would.
So this then takes us round to the Northwest Tower, which is the only one of the four towers still standing.
Yeah.
This is a good place to stop and just take a look at the Northwest Tower. It's basically octagonal in shape with bits added onto it. Now, the bit this side, closest to us, the square tower, that's actually the guardrobe tower. This was high status accommodation. This is where the really important visitors would stay.
Oh, I see.
And there is a toilet on every floor. Your ensuite accommodation.
Absolutely, your ensuite bathroom.
Yeah. When we get inside, you'll see there's also a fireplace on each floor. So high status.
Oh, I really want to know who stayed in there now.
Well, Holbein, Erasmus.
Oh.
Whether the king would have stayed in there, we don't know. Our story is that Thomas Cranmer used one of the rooms as his writing room when he was doing drafts of the English Book of Common Prayer, but we can't prove that.
So we're going to go and have a look now. We're walking towards the entrance of this town. Now, as I say, I've been to Otford a couple of times, but I've never had the privilege of being somebody who's got the key to the door.
I have the key. We'll just have a very quick look.
Yes.
There you can see the remains of the spiral staircase.
Ooh, I'm just getting cobwebs up my nose then as I try and peer in. So there's a grated, metal grated gateway, and I
yes,
can
we
hear
don't,
pigeons.
We don't go in there because there are a lot of pigeons inside.
But yes, you can see the remains, just the remains of the stone.
It's too dangerous to take people in there at the moment. But it won't be. It'll be reinstated with a proper stone staircase.
Fabulous.
Now, there will now be a rattling of keys.
We love a good rattling of keys.
So we're now inside the Northwest Tower.
Oh, I love
it. And you can see that fireplace is being occupied by a pigeon. But you can see there's a fireplace at each level.
Yeah.
And not just any old fireplace. Look at the brickwork.
It's beautiful.
At the back of that one.
And the windows, I mean, you've got one, two, three, four. So the chamber would have been flooded with light.
Yes,
with
we're going to open up
views.
Open up the, some of the windows that have been blocked up so that it will be a very light and airy space.
And as you say, the fireplace is that beautiful, iconic Tudor arch and fabulous brickwork.
And looking at the brickwork, you can see where there are inserts for the supports for the panelling.
Yes.
And tapestries.
Yeah.
High status building. Now, what we're aiming to do is to reinstate the floors. Again, you can see where the original floors would have been. And we've had the structural engineers look at it, and they think that the structure is plenty strong enough still to take a floor. We won't have to put a steel frame inside it to be load-bearing.
Right.
These walls are about 3 feet thick.
It's fantastic. I love it.
And slowly it's drying out. For 300 years, possibly even more, there was no roof on it.
Yes, yeah, so now that's what you've done here, haven't you?
We didn't do that. Historic England did that before we took over. The first phase of the work we're doing is to repair the brickwork and the stonework and to glaze the existing windows and put in a solid door. That'll make it much more waterproof so it can dry out better. And it'll also, said he through gritted teeth, make it pigeon-proof.
I was just going to say, you can then say goodbye to your feathered guests, can't
yes.
you?
And then we can have more people coming in.
Well, thank you so much for showing us round and taking us on a little mini tour of the palace. And I think perhaps we should just go back inside for another cup of tea and just round up with talking about what's happened to the palace over the recent past.
OK, let's do that.
Thank you so much for showing me around the ruins of Otford. But we've come back inside because there's nothing better than to have, well, yet another cup of tea and a biscuit. I mean, how English. But we want to talk a little bit about what happened much later to Otford and why it's in the state it's in now, what's been done about that. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about the more modern history of Otford Palace.
Sure. Around about 1932... the country was looking for a replacement for Croydon Airport. Croydon Airport was to the south of London, very low-lying, very prone to fog. And for a developing country with developing international air routes, judged not suitable. And the idea was that in the hills above the village of Ainsford, now Ainsford's about 4 or 5 miles to the north of here, there was an area which Alan Cobham, Cobham's Flying Circus, had identified as the ideal place for an airport. The site here had just been bought by a builder, and he saw an opportunity. This could be a massive housing estate, There could be industrial opportunities. There was a new railway coming to serve the airport. And so he envisaged a housing estate. Now, it was known that this was a historic site. And there was a lot of public outcry, which involved the Archbishop. There was an inquiry, which was chaired by the Archbishop. And the site was, first of all, transferred to the province of Canterbury. That's the bit, that's the thing that the Archbishop owns. Mm. And then to the Sevenoaks Rural District Council, and that would preserve it.
I see.
He didn't transfer all of the site. He kept a bit for himself. And this is the act of vandalism that I was talking about earlier. He used stones from the moated manor to fill in the southern moat. And that gave him an access road to where he was going to build houses.
I see.
He then started building houses. And that went on for a while. He then stopped. But later on, in the early 1970s, when some more houses were being built, somebody saw that they were starting to dig down through what looked like old foundations. They blew the whistle, all work stopped, and there's been no further building in the area, thank heavens.
Yes, indeed.
Since then. But it did give us the opportunity, not me personally, but it gave the archaeologists the opportunity to excavate the southeast tower. And that's told us a lot about the construction there. Because underneath there are Roman remains and all sorts of interesting things. Now, nothing much then happened until we get it well into the 21st century. But the district council were getting concerned because bits were falling off the tower. And they were of a sufficient size, they would hurt people. Mm. So there were some emergency works put in hand. And then the council realised, not unreasonably, that maintaining the scheduled monument was going to cost them a lot of money. And they looked around for alternative uses. Some of the uses were to convert the tower and possibly also the gatehouse into holiday lets. But economically it was very dubious. At about that point we set up the Archbishop's Palace Conservation Trust and we put in a bid and said, look, lease it to us for a reasonable period of time and we'll turn it into a community asset. Our plans are to have an interpretation centre, a museum, a public meeting space, gallery, that all the sorts of things that you would expect. And that's where we are at the moment, raising money to undertake that work. It's going to cost us about $1.5 million, if you say it quickly. For visitors the other side of the Atlantic, from the other side of the Atlantic, that's around about $2 million US. You say it quickly, it's not too bad,
yes,
is it?
Yes, no. I must admit, it makes me slightly queasy thinking about what the job in hand of trying to raise that amount of money.
But it's lots of fun.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And thank goodness for people like you who are prepared to put in the time and the energy and effort to make sure that these places...
Well, it's a team effort of all of the trustees.
Yes, I can imagine it is.
Well, and a number of other volunteers as well.
Well, there are many, many people, including myself, but many people across the world, I'm sure, listening to this, who will be very grateful that you're doing just that. And so maybe we could just round up by saying, you know, how can people visit here? I know you've got a website that's very informative. There's lots of video on that. But maybe you could tell us how to find that on the web. But also, you know, if they're coming here, anything they might need to know about visitor information?
Well, it's all on the web, as you say. Otfordpalace.org, all one word, Otford Palace. And a Google search, or whatever search engine you happen to use, will get you there. There are Wikipedia entries, but you'll probably do better with the full website. Getting here, it's quite accessible by public transport. 35 minutes by rail from central London, and then a 7-minute walk from the railway station.
Oh, wow, right. Well, that's really good to know.
Easy to get to. There is car parking, of course, if you prefer the...
I can vouch for that.
The non-environmentally friendly way of getting here. We're just physically to the south of Otford Pond. And all roads in Otford lead to Otford Pond.
They do indeed. There's a nice little handy wooden notice I noticed saying Palace. And in fact, you'll be walking not too far from where you live, as you said.
You'll be walking right past my front door.
Maybe people can knock on your door and come for a cup of tea. No,
not actually a tea shop, but never mind. The site, walking around the site itself is free. There's no
restrictions,
No restrictions. All we ask is that you take your litter back home with you.
Well, perfect.
In the fullness of time, when we have the Interpretation Centre and Museum, yes, you will have to pay a fee to come inside, but not to walk around the outside. And as you were saying, there are a number of videos on the website which give you a guided tour round
the Palace. Virtual tour, absolutely. And there's also, of course, My A to Z, if anybody fancies
watching
that.
Yes, I'm sorry, Sarah, I should have mentioned that. There is... What they need to do is look at the A to Z first, because that sets everything in context. And then take the individual videos.
And go into more detail.
Go into more detail. You can put them on your mobile phone and walk around with them.
Okay, well, with that, I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about Otford Palace and to show us around today.
You are more than welcome.
Before we finish the show, remember, you can support my work via my Patreon programme, where various levels of sponsorship are available, starting at just $1 a month. Check out all the details of how to become a patron in the link included with this podcast. Oh, and don't forget, you can be part of my closed Facebook group, where fellow time travellers like you hang out with me and each other to share some of our favourite things about visiting the UK. From great Tudor places to visit, to the best way to take your cream tea in an afternoon. From the latest travel news to the traditional Sunday roast. So don't miss out, and you can apply to join by clicking on the link in the description. So now it's back to close the show. Well, there's no doubt about it, friends. I'm looking forward to the opening of the Heritage and Visitor Centre. And of course, I will keep you posted as things unfold. And I hope that if you are visiting the area, particularly if you're heading to Knowle, you might think about combining that visit to a pop down the road, just a few miles away. Very easy if you have a car to go and visit Otford and soak up the history there. And of course, let me know if you do and let me know what you think. I always love to hear from you. And on that note, if there are any locations that are near to you that you think I should be covering in these podcasts, then of course, drop me a line at sarah@thetudortravelguide.com. I'm always happy to hear from folk and particularly to find out about locations that I haven't yet visited. Although my podcast agenda is planned quite far in advance, it's always great to get a heads up about possible new locations that I can be approaching. So I look forward to hearing from you. Okay, well, any links that have been mentioned in the podcast will be included in the description associated with this episode. And with that, my friends, I think it is all for the time being. The leaves on the trees will be starting to turn colour soon, and certainly summer is drawing to an end. So it's going to be time to cosy up. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere, light those fires and tune into your favourite podcast to soak up your Tudor history while we all plan ahead for our adventures in 2022, God willing. Right, well, that's all for this month. In next month's episode, I in fact will be visiting Knowle. And we'll be getting a brief tour of some of the highlights of the house from one of its very knowledgeable guides. And also, I'll be meeting up there with Sarah Griswood to talk about her new book, which is launched in September, called Tudors in Love. So I hope you can join me then. Until then, my friends, see you around. ¶¶ you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling.